It's my understanding that Ukrainians suffered a lot, particularly starvation, after the Russian Revolution, and welcomed the Nazis initially as liberators, even fought with the Nazis against the Soviets. And that because of that, there's still a lot of ill will between Ukrainians and ethnic Russians. And I just wondered how much of that is still visible and how much of that plays into this crisis.
I think that with regard to the historical story here, there's no question that the Soviet Union did absolutely horrible things to the Ukrainian people after the Russian Revolution. I don't know that it was the Russians doing that to the Ukrainians, and indeed Stalin himself was a Georgian, not a Russian. Furthermore, with regard to the German invasion of the Soviet Union, the Germans were probably the most, Germans in World War II were probably the most murderous people in modern history. And they murdered huge numbers of Ukrainians and Belarusians, as well as they murdered anybody they could get their hands on, to put it bluntly. So it wasn't like it was the Ukrainians and the Germans against the Russians or against the Soviets. There were certainly some Ukrainians who fought with the Germans, but it was hardly anything like all the people. Now, there's no question that inside Ukraine today there is a powerful nationalism, and they are proud of their state, the Ukrainian state, and many of the people in that state would like to be part of the West, and they don't want to be in Russia's orbit. And I believe that, more than the history, is what's driving this crisis, right? And when I give the talk that you just heard, people often say to me, don't the Ukrainians have a right to have a foreign policy of their own? And this is an argument that, of course, resonates in the West, where we place a very high premium on rights. And because we respect the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian state, most people are very sympathetic to the argument that they should have the right to side with the West if they see fit. My response to that is they don't have that right, and it's foolish to talk in those terms. Cuba did not have the right to jump into bed with the Soviet Union militarily from our point of view. We now do not recognize Taiwan's right to declare its independence. Anytime you live next door to a guerrilla, it's very foolish to talk in terms of rights. What you want to do is pay very serious attention to the guerrilla and make sure that you don't do anything to antagonize that guerrilla so that the guerrilla crushes you. The Ukrainians, are in a very precarious strategic situation. They have what I call bad geography. When you have bad geography, you have to be very careful. And this is why I said I think that Western leaders, to include American leaders, are leading the Ukrainians down the primrose path by talking about rights and telling them that they can become part of NATO if they want to. The end result of encouraging that kind of rhetoric is to ruin Ukraine. And I believe that these people in Washington and in Western capitals who purport to be Ukraine's friends are not Ukraine's friends. And the argument that I'm making is friendly to the Ukrainians. It is pro-Ukrainian.
My name is Derek Monroe. Actually, I was in Ukraine, Kiev. We were communicating a few months back during the revolution, quote-unquote revolution, for foreign policy focus out of Washington. And just a comment I'd like to make and a statement. The first statement I'd like to make is that although I was there during the situation taking place and overthrow and a coup, there's absolutely no unequivocal doubt about that. When I was watching the Revolutionary Press Center, I was watching the coverage of the CNN and all the media, I thought I was on a different planet, basically in regards to what was already going on over there. My question to you would be basically economics, because as you probably know, Chevron has really, last November, has signed up a up to $10 million contract with the Yanukovych government about exploration of gas resources, as well as the fracking and a variety of different petroleum resources, and also about current situation with current setup of our American economic interests, specifically also setting up of the new petrochemical conglomerate that actually is headed by Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. So there's definitely a degree of convergence here, not necessarily neoconservative political thought, but also a neoliberal economic thought that comes into together with hand in hand. So I was wondering if you could just make some comments on that.
I assume that what you're getting at is the belief that the United States has economic reasons for encouraging Ukraine to become part of the West. I don't believe that's the case. I think there's no doubt that the United States has economic interests in Ukraine. But I don't think it was necessary to peel Ukraine away from Russia's orbit to realize those economic gains. And I think what's really happening here economically is that not only is Ukraine being wrecked, Russia is being seriously damaged, and I believe that this is going to blow back into the European Union. I would suggest that all of you over the next year just read very carefully, whether you read the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, or whatever, read all the articles on why the European Union is in trouble these days and what the prospects are for the future. And almost every article says that the economic problems being caused by the Ukraine crisis are hurting the economic situation in Western Europe. This is why the German business elites are adamantly opposed to sanctions being imposed on the Russians. And they are telling Merkel loudly and clearly that if she continues to ramp up the sanctions, even maintain the present sanctions on Russia, this is going to blow back and do damage to the European Union. And you all know that the European Union, because of the euro crisis, is in deep trouble anyway, independent of what's going on in Ukraine. So I think, if anything, right, by precipitating this crisis and then doubling down, which has been our policy, to double down instead of backing off and rethinking what we're doing, we're making the economic situation for Russia, Ukraine, and Western Europe worse. And that is not to our benefit, because we need a strong international economy to make our economy, the American economy, grow.
They have been using petrodollars to purchase arms. They're running out of petrodollars. And so the question would be, how long can the Russians keep up this confrontation? Do they need to blink because they can't afford to keep troops in the field?
This is actually a very important question. And his question boils down to this. Will the economic punishment that we are inflicting on the Russians, and by the way, that economic punishment is not only due to sanctions, it's also due, in fact, it's due more so to the drastic drop in world oil prices. That more than the sanctions is hurting the Russians, but it's a double whammy, okay? So his question is, will that economic pain, that punishment, cause Putin and the Russians to throw up their hands and concede defeat to the West? That's the question. And what this really all...
Will they run out of keep forces in the field?
Well, they'll be able to keep forces in the field. The point is that those forces will be somewhat diminished. And to maintain those forces in the field, they'll have to rob Peter to pay Paul, right? And that will cause more economic hardship at home, right? But what this really all boils down to is how you think a country that believes it faces an existential threat or feels that its security, its core security is threatened, will behave in the face of economic punishment. And the historical record, in my opinion, makes it absolutely clear that countries that feel their core strategic interests are at stake will pay an enormous economic price and will not throw their hands up. So I think there is little reason to believe that the economic pain that's being inflicted on the Russians, even if it continues, will cause them to throw up their hands, because strategic interests are at stake. Core strategic interests are at stake. And basically what that means is your survival's at stake. Rick was talking about the possibility of nuclear weapons being used. I agree with everything he said. But the mere fact that he's talking about nuclear weapons being used, just the mere fact that he mentioned it, that I mentioned it, that Mikhail Gorbachev mentioned it, that tells you that the Russians are really serious here. And by the way, Putin mentioned the subject of nuclear weapons right after the crisis began. He reminded the West that I have nuclear weapons, right? This is to say that this is a crisis of great importance to them. Their core strategic interests are at stake, and I do not think all of the economic punishment we can inflict on them, which is considerable, will get them to throw their hands up.
How do you reconcile
about our policy towards Russia and towards expanding NATO? Is that coming, am I just simplistic, to think it has to do with the military-industrial complex? What is it that's really the hard driver of it? And then Europe, why does it go along? It doesn't seem to me that they don't have such a large military industry. What's in it for them?
Is the expansion of NATO into Europe to further the economic interests of the military-industrial complex? That's a question I believe I heard. My answer then is in part, and maybe even in major part. Let me explain. Today, the Polish press announces that four Polish MiG-29s, MiG-19s, are being deployed to the Baltics as part of what's called the NATO Air Patrol. This is something that was instituted within days of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania being brought into NATO in 2009. It has continued now for, for that entire period of, 2004. So it's continued for 11 years. Initially, there were four advanced kind of new generation warplanes provided by different countries rotating. There are currently 16. That is the number of warplanes in Lithuania and Estonia. NATO warplanes has been quadrupled. However, that's going to be the last MiG plane that Poland ever flies, because at the beginning of this century, the subservient government in Warsaw signed a deal with the United States to purchase 48 F-16s. That's a colossal expenditure. It's the largest single military purchase in Polish history, bar none, and that's not the end of it. Immediately afterwards, the U.S. tried to entice Bulgaria and Romania, who had joined NATO in 2004, Poland 5 years earlier, to purchase from 24 to 36 F-16s each. That didn't materialize because of the economic downturn of 2008. But, the fact is, yes. And not only American merchants of death, if you will, arms manufacturers, but the European arms manufacturers are cleaning up on this. With NATO expansion over the last 15 years, Germany, as of recently, last time I saw, is the third largest arms exporter in the world. Sweden is a major exporter of arms and has participated actively in NATO's last two wars. I don't know if people know these things. Sweden had several hundred troops still to this day serving under NATO in Afghanistan in the first armed conflict in 200 years in that nation's history. Serving along with Finnish troops who have not been involved in combat since World War II. Swedish Gripen airplanes participated in the air war against Libya. And there's one fellow in particular in Sweden, an American expatriate named Al Burke. I invite you to look him up. He has a website called Help Stop Sweden's Furtive Accession to NATO. And, you can read this. Go do a Google News search on Sweden and NATO day by day. You know, each day the numbers are inching up of the amount of Swedes ready to support integration into NATO as a full member state. There, you know, the Ukraine crisis is being used to create the panic necessary. You, some of you may have seen the statement by a military official in Sweden a little while ago that the Russians could be in Stockholm in 20 minutes at the rate of our military. You know, I mean, these. No, the second part of your question. Why are the Europeans going along with this? They're making a lot of money from weapons. And I think, you know, to go back to the previous, one of the previous questions, we have to acknowledge that Russia has basically two export products. They have arms and they have hydrocarbons. And when you prevent them from selling arms to Europe because of NATO interoperability regulations, which says that any NATO member or any NATO candidate member can only purchase arms that are interoperable with American, German, French, British, Swedish, and other Western arms, then you effectively cut Russia out of the arms market in Europe. If the European Union, which is the second largest consumer of energy in the world next to the United States, and has been receiving 25 or 30% of its natural gas from Russia, now, as if Russia is cut out of that market because of the Ukraine crisis, and by the way, the Yushchenko government, when it was in power a few years ago, you know, started a reverse flow process with natural gas, which was the beginning of the process of squeezing Russia out of the European energy market. This is economic warfare. This is targeting a government to say, essentially, your major export products are not going to your major market. And I can assure you again, if the situation were reversed, we'd deal with that in a pretty firm manner. Does that answer your question?
Two quick questions. One, what was the role of the U.S. or its proxies in the protests of November 2013? And secondly, wasn't Crimea historically a part of Russia?
I think almost everybody agrees that Crimea was historically a part of Russia, and that in 1954, Nikita Khrushchev, some reason, decided to give Ukraine Crimea as a birthday present. And because Ukraine and Russia were then both part of the Soviet Union, and nobody in 1954 was thinking that the Soviet Union was going to disappear and there would be an independent Ukrainian and Russian state. It was not a very meaningful gesture. And the reason that it was relatively easy for Russia to take Crimea and justify it was because the majority of people in Crimea are Russian and wanted to become part of Russia and abandon Crimea. So I think that, you know, your description of the history is correct. Your first question is, what was American participation in the events leading up to and including the February 22nd coup? It's really hard to get your hands around the details on this because most of the details haven't come out. But it's very clear that Victoria Nuland, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for Eastern Europe, and John McCain, just to pick two people, actually participated in the protests. Furthermore, it's very clear that the United States had upped the amount of resources that it was funneling to the opposition to Yanukovych in 2013 and in early 2014. We were funding the opposition. It's also clear that Victoria Nuland and the Americans more generally were working with the people who then came to power after Yanukovych was disposed, and that they had made it clear, we know this from intercepted telephone conversations, that they wanted to see the people who are now running Ukraine in power. So our fingerprints are there. The extent to which we were involved is hard to tell. My guess is, and this is just a guess, is that once we get all the information, this may take 20 or 30 years, but once we get all the information, you'll see major American involvement.
With respect to the following two events, one is the oil price, when it's politically engineered. Second is about Malaysia and Flight 17. Who shut it down, please?
I have no really good answer to either one of those questions. I certainly have no answer to the second question, and I don't even know that it was shot down. Okay, so I don't know much about what happened there. And with regard to your first question, I don't know what to say on that one either. We just don't have much information.
When you talk about a country facing existentialist threats, you talk about them willing to take any sacrifice. You say Ukraine shouldn't have a choice to determine its own path forward. You know, we're talking about 45 million people here themselves. Unless are they just fodder between this great powers war of Russia and America?
Well, I just want to be clear. I made the point, I think, in my formal remarks and in at least one of my responses, that I was deeply concerned about the Ukrainian people, and I think that the Ukrainian people are being badly hurt by Western policy. I made the argument that the West is leading the Ukrainian people down the primrose path. Pardon?
They're not leading themselves.
No, the Ukrainians, of course, are foolishly playing right into the hands of the Americans by agreeing with the Americans. Ukrainian leaders and Western leaders are both foolishly pursuing roughly the same policy. So it's not like the Ukrainians are protesting. The Ukrainians are buying the rhetoric that the West is promoting. And look at what the end result is. I ask you, what do you think is going to happen to Ukraine if we continue the present policies? Do you have a happy ending to your story?
I do.
What is the happy ending?
I think we will bankrupt Russia in this process with the help of oil prices and our sanctions. And I think Ukraine will probably partition off this eastern part and for 3 years give them full autonomy and reform their economy to move more towards the West, because that's what the people want right now. And when you're faced with an existential threat with a big gorilla next to you, and he keeps coming in and killing your people and masterminding ways to undermine your entire existential existence as a country, you do make the hard choices.
Yes, but the point you want to remember is that the United States and the West Europeans are not going to help you. They're not going to help you. They're going to abandon you.
Well, right now, also, you made a comment that Ukrainians are willing to die for this cause. They are dying for this cause. They haven't gotten much from the West. And I do believe that I don't think they'll be abandoned by the West, but I do believe that they have taken destiny into their own hands on the back of what...
I've been around long enough to say that I might not be right, and you may be right. I don't think so. You may be right, and I think we're going to run the experiment because most people agree with you. But yes, I just make one quick point to him. But I would just say you do not want to underestimate how ruthless the Russians can be when they feel threatened. And the Ukrainian people, who have a lot of experience dealing with the Russians, should know better.
How do you feel about the whole way that Obama and his administration have handled the Ukraine and other foreign policies?
Well, as I made clear, and I believe Rick made clear in his comments, NATO expansion, which is the principal driving force behind this crisis, began in the Clinton administration. The first tranche was, as he pointed out, and I believe I did too, in 1999. I think the second major tranche was 2004, right? And in 2008, remember we both talked about the April 2008 Bucharest conference, the NATO conference, where they said that Ukraine and Georgia would become part of NATO. That was under George W. Bush, right? And of course, Barack Obama has been in the driver's seat over the course of the 2013-2014 period. So there's really no one president who bears responsibility for this. It's a whole string of presidents who have been acting according to the same basic logic that has precipitated this crisis.
I'm wondering if I may say something in regard to an earlier question, because I don't want this to pass unnoticed. The question about the Ukrainian people's will. You know, I find it very interesting that in 2010, a presidential election, a runoff election, granted there's a multi-party system in Ukraine, it's far more democratic than our own, or was, until the current junta started purging political parties that didn't agree with it. You've seen the YouTube videos of some of the great freedom fighters and democracy advocates beating up journalists in their office, assaulting members of parliament and so forth. This is something, you know, evocative of Germany in the early 1930s, not of a democratic government. But there was to have been a presidential election in March of this year. The Ukrainian people voted in a runoff election in 2010 for Viktor Yanukovych. This is not a question of what the Ukrainian people, and I don't know who this individual is that he presumes to speak on behalf of the Ukrainian people. But, you know, the only facts we have available to us is how people vote. And if people in Ukraine had changed their opinion on Mr. Yanukovych, they only had to wait 11 months to vote him out. Instead of burning down parts of the capital city, throwing Europe into a crisis, and starting off a 270-day war. I don't believe, there, outside of a few nationalist extremists in the northwest part of the country, anyone in Ukraine desired that.
Professor Mearsheimer, when you began, you talked about this being driven by NATO expansion, EU expansion, and democracy promotion. You have said basically nothing other than laying that out about the democracy promotion efforts. Can you go into that? Can you elaborate about the National Endowment for Democracy and what they were doing in the Ukraine?
Well, as I said in response to a previous question, we don't have a lot of information at this point in time on what the United States did to facilitate the coup on February 22nd, 2014. But on the general subject of democracy promotion, what we were interested in doing was giving lots of money to the Ukrainians so that they could develop democratic institutions and they could have elections, and then we gave money to opposition politicians, politicians who were opposed to Yanukovych, so that we would maximize their chances of getting elected in subsequent elections. And of course, these people would be beholden to us, one, because we had supported them, but two, because they were liberal Democrats who identified with the West. So they would be our friends. In a very important way, it's not hard to understand why the United States did this. But the key thing that you want to understand is that it drove the Russians crazy. Now, Ambassador McFaul, who I believe was the American ambassador in Moscow from 2012 to 2014, was deeply involved in promoting democracy inside of Russia, which angered the Russian leadership to no end. Right, and they just had all sorts of problems with him. But this is just another way in which we were promoting democracy. In this case, it was inside Russia. And you want to understand that promoting democracy in Ukraine is not simply designed to put in place in Ukraine a leader who's pro-Western. It's also linked to the argument that that impulse for democracy might spread across the border to Russia, and that will be the end for Putin. And as I said in the Foreign Affairs article, actually the head of the endowment hinted that that would be the case, that eventually Putin would fall victim to these democratic forces. Needless to say, this is going to drive the Russians crazy. And by the way, I also do a lot of work on China. I've been to China. This kind of rhetoric drives the China, and this kind of behavior drives the Chinese crazy as well. And if you look at the protests in Hong Kong, the Chinese press is filled with articles that say the Americans are behind the protests in Hong Kong. I believe there's no evidence to support that. But what it shows you is that there's widespread belief around the world that the United States is trying to topple governments to put in power people who are pro-Western, and that countries like Russia and countries like China, not surprisingly, do not like that at all, and they tend to lash out.
I really feel that there are some in the U.S. foreign policy elite that think that the U.S. will eventually have to have some type of war with China. And I wonder, using Professor Mearsheimer's peeling off analogy. If the U.S. isn't now peeling off Russia, I have a second question that's related. I realize that I do not know the name of a single one of Obama's foreign policy advisors on Russia and China, and I have no idea who his national security advisor is.
His national security advisor is Susan Rice, and probably the most prominent member of his administration on the foreign policy front is John Kerry. He really doesn't have a Secretary of Defense now, but I think John Kerry is the public face of the administration outside the president himself. It's very interesting. I have no good feel for who made policy on Ukraine up to the February 22nd coup, and I have no good sense, and I've talked to lots of people, as to who's driving the train since February 22nd. There's this woman, Victoria Nuland, who I mentioned before, who's the Assistant Secretary of State for Eastern European Affairs. She's a very key player in the events before February 22nd or leading up to February 22nd, but I don't have a good sense of who she was reporting to, who was monitoring her. There are a number of people I know who think that she was sort of a lone wolf. She was kind of on her own. And one of the problems here is that we're so bogged down in our wars in the Middle East or in the greater Middle East that Obama doesn't have much time to spend thinking about Ukraine. And this is what allowed her to have all the freedom to formulate policy that she apparently had. I don't know whether that's the case. There are also people, just for your information, who argue that what has happened with regard to Ukraine is that the Americans have sort of turned the portfolio over to Angela Merkel, that we're relying very heavily on the Germans to deal with the Russians, and not to manage this problem, but to take the lead in a very subtle and sophisticated kind of way, because we're pinned down. When you're a global superpower like the United States and you're trying to run the world, right, you oftentimes have to outsource problems. And there are people who argue, I don't know whether it's true for sure, that the Germans are doing a lot of the heavy lifting with regard to Ukraine, and that's why it's hard to see the fingerprints of a Susan Rice or a John Kerry. But I would just say, as a general point, I don't have a good feel for who's behind our policy up to the coup and then after the coup. With regard to your first question, which is a fascinating question, I was in Japan for 10 days in December. And the Japanese, as you know, Hillary Clinton had announced in 2011 that we're going to pivot to Asia. And the pivot to Asia is all about the fact that we care greatly about the rise of China, and we're thinking that we have to be there to back up our allies in Asia. And this, of course, includes the Japanese, the South Koreans, the Filipinos, Taiwanese, Vietnamese, and so forth and so on. But the Japanese view is, number one, you can't pivot to Asia if you start a war against ISIS in the Middle East, and then you cause a crisis in Eastern Europe that's going to cause you to redouble your efforts in Europe to contain Russia, if you start doing all the things that Rick was concerned about, right? So number one, the pivot to Asia is not looking very good from a Japanese point of view, which scares them. Second, it raises all sorts of questions about America's judgment. Number three, and this gets at your point, it drives the Russians into the arms of the Chinese. And from a Japanese point of view, they would prefer the Russians to be allied with the Japanese and the Americans against the Chinese in the future. But exactly the opposite is happening. And then finally, the Japanese are very concerned about getting back the Kuril Islands that they lost after World War II, that the Russians now control. And the Japanese thought they were making significant progress with Putin and with the Russians more generally on getting those islands back. And they believe that because the Americans are now leaning on them, we're leaning on the Japanese to be tough with the Russians, they're not going to get the Kuril Islands back, right? So I think that your basic point about the geostrategic consequences of what's happening with regard to Ukraine on our Asian policy or on geopolitics in Asia is correct. And if you were to go to Japan, you would find people talking there much the way you were talking. I think Rick raised the issue of the Kosovo bombings, and I think he can tell me if I'm wrong, that he raised it in the context of talking about the fact that the United States and the West Europeans, have been playing tough with the Russians almost since the breakup of the former Soviet Union. He was also talking about missile defense in Eastern Europe, which is another one of those issues that just drives the Russians up a tree. Right. Although Obama did go to some lengths to try and placate them on that issue. But that was the context in which he raised Kosovo. Libya, by the way, is another case, right? You know, they thought that they went along with us on Libya in 2011, thinking it was designed to protect innocent Libyans from being murdered. And then we used the UN resolution that came out of the Security Council basically to overthrow Gaddafi. And this enraged the Russians, and it's why they wouldn't play ball with us on Syria.
Yeah, the project of the American Century, which was actually a neocon favorite project, actually, Robert King was actually head of that. He's actually married to the Victoria Nuland. So it's a family affair as we speak. Also, another issue which can actually not really mention U.S. media specifically, what I wrote about this, is that the outsourcing has got a really curious balance when it comes to Kyiv. There's a lot of money being funneled into the quote-unquote right-wing opposition from Konrad Adenauer Foundation of Germany. There's an office of the so-called, nobody talks about, USAID Office of Strategic Initiatives, which gave lots of money to different, you know, right-wing groups. What's most curious about all, and I never thought, I'm 46 years old, I've ever seen in my life, there were IDF personnel, Israeli Defense Forces personnel officers, training neo-Nazis from Sokolna Sprava in Kyiv. I've heard my own eyes, my ears, what I've heard Hebrew gentlemen actually instructing the shock troops from Sokolna Sprava and from the variety of different groups, just as private sector, what have you. So you really cannot make this stuff up. The outsourcing that's taking place right now, it brings a variety of different characters from worldwide spectrum into this quote-unquote situation in Kyiv, which is very disturbing overall.
Well, you obviously know more than I do, but I just want to make two points. One point that I didn't bring up in my comments, just because of time considerations, is that it is clear that there were fascists, I mean real fascists, involved in the opposition to Yanukovych, and that a number of those fascists then held important positions in the government that replaced the Yanukovych government. Second point I'd make is that one problem that Americans have is they have little sense of history, their own history and certain other people's history. But in 1917, Russia dropped out of World War I. It lost the war. It was invaded by Germany. It suffered a catastrophic defeat. In World War II, thankfully, it won the war. The Soviet Union played the key role in defeating Nazi Germany. It was not the United States. As I like to tell students, when we landed on the Normandy beaches on June 6, 1944, less than 1 year before the war ended, at that point in time, 93% of all German casualties were on the Eastern Front. 93% were on the Eastern Front. To defeat Nazi Germany in World War II involved a huge bloodletting. Whoever played the key role in defeating Nazi Germany would pay a god-awful blood price. Right, and that was the Soviet Union. They lost 24 million people. 16 million of those people were civilian, and of the 8 million military deaths, 3.3 were POWs who were murdered by the Germans. Right, so they were dealing with Murder Incorporated, which gets back to my earlier response about Germans in Ukraine. But anyway, all of this is to say that when you're dealing with a country like Russia, and you're dealing with this history, and you're talking about moving a military alliance up to their doorstep, right? You're really asking for trouble.
A few days ago, I saw these banderas the neo-Nazi signs and so on, and having a nice time. The other guys which came into the vocabulary with Nolan was the Yatsenik. He's also, I've seen them very close to fascists in Ukraine. 2 days ago in Germany, this is exactly what he said, you have to prevent the Russians invading Germany again. That is the first time, which was the Second World War. They invaded you. You didn't invite them. So where are these Democrats?
That's a very good question. And what we're talking about with the democracy promotion thing, I'm going to tie together two things very interesting. In Dr. Mearsheimer's article in Foreign Affairs, he does mention that in the infamous tape of Victoria Nuland, by the way, the least offensive thing she had to say, in my estimate, was the four-letter expletive she used. Everything else was far more offensive and even obscene. But she did handpick, as Dr. Mearsheimer mentioned, you know, Arseniy Yatsenyuk as being, you know, the next head of government. And in fact, he, you know, is filling exactly that role. But, you know, we have to recall, again, along the lines of what Professor Mearsheimer has been saying. This isn't a question, you know, I'm reminded of Lewis Lapham of Harper's Magazine years ago saying, in the United States, you have a provisional government and a permanent government, and you certainly do in relation to foreign policy. So Victoria Nuland was actually U.S. Permanent representative, U.S. ambassador to NATO under the George W. Bush administration. She's currently Undersecretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs under the Obama administration, and whoever replaces Obama, I'm sure, is going to find some position for Ms. Nuland. So you have continuity that's fully bipartisan, and in fact, political differences end at the shoreline when it comes to, you know, to geopolitical maneuvering. But we have an industry, which is, I think, what you're alluding to, and the infamous Hashim Thaçi in Kosovo is a poster child for U.S. democracy promotion. Gangsterism, narcotics trafficking, murdering people for body parts. Up until a couple of years ago, his closest competitor was Mikhail Saakashvili in Georgia. These are America's two darlings. I mean, a superpower of unprecedented proportion can find no better clients than Hashim Thaçi and Mikhail Saakashvili, but in fact, that was the case. Now, Saakashvili may end up in prison in his own country, but he's been in Kiev recently, as some of you may know, you know, egging on the Poroshenko government to really go at Russia. I guess he's got a grudge match. He was educated, by the way, at Columbia University here. You know, Mr. Yushchenko, the great democracy advocate, I presume this fellow is, okay. Mr. Yushchenko's wife is Catherine Yushchenko, born and raised in Chicago, an alumnus of the University of Chicago, incidentally, served in positions in both the Ronald Reagan administration and the George H.W. Bush administration as First Lady of Ukraine. I think she eventually condescended to become a Ukrainian citizen after she was First Lady. But, you know, the president of Estonia now, Tuomas Ilves, was raised in the United States, worked for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, or Voice of America, one or the other. You know, what we're talking about here is almost American Janissaries. People, you know, from the diaspora of various countries, trained in the United States, worked for the federal government, worked at least for the State Department, maybe worse, or sent back to govern their respective homelands on behalf of the empire. But when you're talking about the color revolution technique, because it was alluded to earlier too, we have to remember that, you know, America's darling in the 2005 election in the so-called Orange Revolution, when Yushchenko, when he ran for re-election 5 years later, got 5% of the vote. So apparently when National Endowment for Democracy and the Freedom House and Heritage Foundation withholds the money, you don't do too well. But, you know, the model is the one that was originally elaborated in Yugoslavia in the autumn of 2000 with Otpor, replicated in the, you know, with Kamara in Georgia, Pora in Ukraine, Kyrgyzstan, Lebanon, Moldova, arguably most recently. And that's why I think Professor Mearsheim is correct in identifying this color revolution technology as being, you know, really the third factor. In addition to NATO and European expansion, the three are inextricably connected.
There was a remarks made about, you know, where do we go from here? How do we deal with these solutions? And I want to know if you, any speaker, wanted to comment on the economic aspect of this. And the way I see it is that what we have now is a move, it's a very clear move by the government in Washington to establish global economic dominance of American imperialism in Europe, controlling the EU, and also also moving toward China.
I'll answer that question, but before I do, I just want to make a point regarding the previous question. There's a new book out by Michael Glennon, G-L-E-N-N-O-N. I don't have the name of the book on the top of my, in my frontal lobes, but he teaches at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. You can go to his website, and he has an article on the website that is effectively a manuscript version of the book. It's published by a Harvard journal, like the Harvard Journal of National Security Affairs, if you don't want to buy the book. It's a terribly important book, and it deals with, and this was a point that Rick was getting at, what I call the deep government. And he raises the question at the front of the book, why is it that Barack Obama, who came to office promising to have a completely different foreign policy from George W. Bush, has really acted pretty much the way George W. Bush acted, and in some cases has been worse than George W. Bush, right? Why do they look like Tweedledee and Tweedledum on the foreign policy front? This is his question. And his argument, this is my rhetoric, is because of the deep state, right? Presidents come and go, but the deep state remains intact. And it is really a fascinating book, and it would be well worth your reading. And for those who are interested in this whole issue of how much presidents really matter, right? And again, it's Michael Glennon, G-L-E-N-N-O-N, and you just go to the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy website, and you can find the manuscript or the article version, which is basically the book. With regard to your question about economics, look, I think the United States has a deep-seated interest in being the dominant economic power on the planet. There's no question about that. It's what's made the United States so powerful. And I think the main reason, to get back to this woman's question in the rear, that we're so worried about the Chinese these days is because we hypothesize a situation where China becomes a giant Hong Kong. In other words, it has a per capita GNP like Hong Kong. And given that it's going to have about four times as many people as us in the year 2050, if it has a per capita GNP like Hong Kong, oh my God, it's going to be much more powerful than the United States. So the United States does care, apropos your question about American dominance. But the United States is not interested in going around the world and wrecking the Russian economy, wrecking the Ukrainian economy, wrecking the European economy. And in fact, for us to remain really filthy rich in the years ahead, it's very important that these other economies prosper as well. Okay? So, for example, there was no evidence that we were out to undermine Russia's economy before February 22, 2014. And we have no interest whatsoever in wrecking Ukraine's economy, and certainly the West European economies, the EU, okay? Now, with regard to the Ukraine crisis, in 2013, remember I told you that what got this whole ball rolling in the fall of 2013 was that the president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, was negotiating with the EU to concoct an economic deal that would benefit Ukraine. In the end, Yanukovych abandoned that deal, and he went with the Russian deal, the deal that Putin was putting forward. Putin actually had been saying all along, don't make it an either-or choice for the Ukrainians. The EU was making it an either-or choice. You either go with us or you go with the Russians. Putin was saying, don't do that. The Russians, the EU, the IMF, and the United States can all work together to make Ukraine prosperous. The fact is that Putin has a deep-seated interest in making Ukraine into a prosperous country. He doesn't want it to be part of the West, but he wants it to be prosperous because it's in Russia's economic interest to have a neighbor that is economically successful. And it, as I said before, is in the interest of the West Europeans, of the European Union, to have a prosperous Ukraine and also to have a prosperous Russia. The Germans export huge amounts of products to Russia. They don't want the Russian economy to go in the toilet. They want the Russian economy to prosper. They want Russian consumers to have lots of money so that they can buy German Audis or German Volkswagens or what have you. Everybody has a vested interest, right, in being rich in the story, and that includes the United States. So I don't see the United States, absent this crisis, doing things that are designed or pursuing policies that are designed to hurt those economies. The Chinese is a different story, right? The Chinese economy is a different story. I believe if we, down the road, have the opportunity to damage the Chinese economy, we would take advantage of that because they have the potential to become Godzilla. And the United States will not be happy about that. But that's a different issue. So I don't see in the European context and in the context of the Ukraine crisis or the Russia-West conference crisis, the problem that you illustrate or highlight.
What's your assessment of the role the reserve currency status of the dollar plays?
For better or for worse, I'm not an economist. So I'm not terribly well qualified to answer this question. I would just say that almost everybody I know believes that the fact that the dollar is the reserve currency, to put it in your rhetoric, plays to our advantage in ways that you described, that this is something that we should cherish, and it allows us to maintain a huge military and to go all over the world doing X, Y, and Z. And most people I know believe that if the dollar stopped being the reserve currency, this would not be a good thing. And there are a lot of people who believe that given the way we're headed and given where China is headed, that the day may come where the dollar is not the reserve currency, and that will greatly limit our ability to project power around the world. So I think that the thrust of what you said is not terribly controversial. I think the $64,000 question is whether or not China will continue to rise economically and put itself in a position where the yuan can be a replacement for the dollar or can threaten the dollar in any meaningful way. There are a lot of people who believe that for the foreseeable future, the dollar will remain the reserve currency and that that will allow us to continue to do X, Y, and Z around the world. I think with regard to the specific crisis that we have been talking about here today, the Ukrainian crisis, right, there's no question that the fact that the dollar is a reserve currency gives us all sorts of capabilities and did allow us to think in terms of expanding NATO. I mean, I think one of the most important things I learned from listening to Rick talk is just how ambitious we are in terms of incorporating countries in Europe and around the world into, was it a global NATO you called
partners
it?
Across the globe.
Partners across the globe. Right. The United States does have a powerful imperial impulse built into it, right? And as I like to point out, this is off the subject somewhat, but the United States has been at war for 2 out of every 3 years since the Cold War ended. The war against ISIS is our 7th war. It's our 7th war since the Cold War ended. We've been at war for 2 out of every 3 years. And I've said in writing and I've said in many public appearances that the United States is addicted to war. We're addicted to war. And by the way, the British have gone with us into every one of those wars, the two great liberal democracies. So anybody who tells you that liberal democracies don't like war is missing some important part of the story. So we have this impulse to sort of gobble up all sorts of countries, include them in our alliance structure, fight lots of wars. Because, of course, if people don't go along with us, then we try to topple the regime, right? You want to understand, I was talking about regime change in Georgia and Ukraine with the Rose Revolution and the Orange Revolution. I also mentioned Taiwan, but there's Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Assad in Syria. We could go on and on. The United States thinks that it has the right to go around the world. Not only has the right, it has the responsibility. Right? We have the right and the responsibility to go around the world doing social engineering, sometimes at the end of a rifle barrel. And what we're trying to do is reorder the world in ways that we believe suit America's interests. And this is a question for another day, but you have to ask yourself, you know, whether you think that's working very well. And it seems to me that the answer is quite clear that it's not working.